Bruh, what caused God? Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today I'm talking about my least favorite arguments for atheism, and I'll be naming a couple which I think are stronger. Recently, I did an episode, which is kind of the inverse of this, where I talked about arguments in favor of theism that I don't like very much, and ones which I think are a bit better. So this is kind of the companion episode. Without any further ado, let's start the list. This might be the one which I think is the worst, and you may have heard it before. You are an atheist about thousands of other gods. I just believe in one less god than you. And this is the perfect time to plug our friend John DeRosa's book, One Less God Than You, where he talks about a lot of such atheist slogans, and he debunks them. Not only does he have that book out, but he also has a free link to everything in the book, which I have included in the show notes. And by the way, if you want to support this podcast, don't. Go and instead support other ones. And John DeRosa's Classical Theism is looking for more patrons. So go over there, sign up, let him know that I sent you. Another one is, I know Trent Horn's trying to up his base, and he's got some cool stuff he's working on. So these guys are some of my top ones to go and support. So go and do that, and look at that link. You got a free book. Kerbam. So here's a couple ways that you can respond to such objections that you are just an atheist about one more god. You might just say, what do you mean? I do believe in all those gods. I believe in all of the gods that fit the classical theistic definition. So I believe in the Christian God, the Jewish God, the Islamic God, some conceptions of the Hindu God, the God of Plato, the God of Aristotle. If you squint, maybe the God of the Stoics. Heck, if we're targeting a principled and rational monotheism, throw in Zoroastrianism in the mix too. Sure. So anything that seems to be targeting the God of classical theism, I agree with. Even if I disagree with what I see as major errors in the description of this God, or if I completely disagree with the theology wrapped around this God. I mean, there's even plenty of Protestant philosophers that think God can change, or God could be in time. And all that's just philosophical nonsense. But that shows that, well, they're just wrong in their description of a real being that we agree about. So they're trying to talk about the same entity, which I'm talking about, but hey, people make mistakes. Maybe even I'm making the mistake, but that doesn't mean that we're not targeting the same entity. And furthermore, if I wanted to, I could go ahead and affirm the existence of other gods too, like Athena or Zeus or Thor or whatever else you want to come up with. Why? Well, because as a Christian, Christian theology says that many of these gods were demons. So I believe that demons exist. Therefore, I do think they're targeting a real existing thing. But again, we just disagree with the mythology, the philosophy, and the theology describing that actually existing thing. So what I reject here is not somebody's claim about a god, either uppercase G god, one which matches classical theism, or lowercase g god, just a spiritual being which seems to be higher in some way than us. What I'm rejecting is false philosophy or theology, which is attributed to these actually existing deities or so-called deities. So there you go. You could just say, no, I'm not. I'm not an atheist about those. I just think some of those points that they make about them are wrong. Now, here's what the atheist is rejecting. You gotta keep an eye on what they're doing here. They are rejecting every formulation ever of an ultimate grounding reality in the form of a self-existent being who has a simple act of existence. And they're doing that in favor of brute facts or ad hoc explanations. So that's what you're rejecting. You're also rejecting every single non-physical entity that has ever been referred to as a god across the whole sweep of human history. And guess what? There are very few facts more unanimously believed across all times and places and cultures than the fact of the existence of spirits, both good and evil. And yet you reject them all. So in other words, I stand in solidarity with the prodigious philosophical tradition which goes back thousands of years. I stand in solidarity with all of these religious traditions and with the observable evidence collected across every language, culture, and place amongst billions and billions of people who all claim that there is such thing as a spiritual reality. You, on the other hand, stand as a historical and philosophical abnormality without an epistemological leg to stand on. So in short, claiming that I am an atheist about all other traditions is false. Being an atheist means I don't believe in this God, but God can be used in a classical theistic or a more broad sense. And in both cases, I'm not rejecting the God. I'm just rejecting the particular mythology, theology, or philosophy surrounding or seeking to explain that same entity. If a bunch of people saw a dog running towards them, and one person said, "I think it's a poodle," and another said, "I think it's a mastiff that's just really far away," and someone said, "I think it's a chihuahua at short distance." Well, denying that it is a poodle coming at you is not denying that it's a dog. It's denying its characteristics. It's saying that somebody could have observed it accurately, and some other people observed it inaccurately. So I think that there is a God, that there are spirits, that there are things which are not strictly natural or material, which are coming at us. And that all these different traditions and religions are saying the same thing. There's something there. And then the ones which are not my tradition are simply describing it wrong. Sometimes really, really wrong. But they're pointing to something. And so am I. Here's another way you can answer it, if you don't want to, you know, take that tact, which is understandable. How about this? Einstein found, what was it, 10,000 or whatever ways to not build a light bulb, as the saying goes. So we all agree those bulbs didn't work. What if I said, I just go one light bulb further? No light bulbs exist. See how that would be an obvious and ridiculous non sequitur? There's a phenomenon that needs to be explained, and there's an enormous difference between rejecting failed light bulb designs and rejecting all light bulb designs. So I think there's a lot of wrong ways to build a conception of God. So I think the Muslim way, I think the Greek way, I think a lot of ways are wrong, but that does no more to disprove the existence of a right way to conceptualize this, as the failed examples of light bulbs disprove the fact that light bulbs can and do function. And finally, there's the famous example of you find a murder victim stabbed in the face in the streets with fingerprints, bloody fingerprints on the knife. We start interrogating people. Maybe we interrogate everybody on Earth, and we're up to, how many people do we have? Like 7 billion now? So we're up to 6.5 billion people interrogated, and they're all found to be innocent. Would you say, well, maybe everybody's innocent. Maybe there is no murderer. You know, I just go one more innocent person than you. Now, that's silly. There's something that needs to be explained, and there's a categorical difference between saying, hey, these are not explanations, and we need one, and saying, there is no explanation. But let me just do one more example. There is a group that I don't like either, but really gets the atheists riled up, and those are the young Earth creationists. What if I said, Mr. Atheist, that my young Earth creationist friend said that you're claiming that life sprung out of some type of primordial soup one miraculous time, but you reject every other time that the lightning struck the primordial soup represented by, let's say, the Watson and Crick experiment. You believe everything else on that early planet was abiotic. And my young Earth creationist friend just goes one. He's just abiotic about one more potentially self-replicating life precursor than you. He just denies one more thing than you do. What would you say to that? You'd say that's a stupid argument and doesn't make any sense. And that's how I feel about this one less God than you objection. So there's a couple ways you can go about this, but I think it's quite weak. What might you want to say instead? What's a more intelligent objection? Well, how about something like this? You could say, if God willed for us to follow him, it seems unlikely that he would allow for so much inconsistent and contradictory information about his nature. See, that's a little bit better. Instead of one less God than you, you might say, wouldn't your theory predict a little bit more religious cohesion? And that's better. However, as I framed it here, this would be an internal critique. So they're saying, under your assumptions, Mr. Theist, X does not make sense. But here's the thing. We actually claim already inside of our theory that God does universally appeal through conscience, through natural law, and he makes possible natural acts of religion. So he does provide those basics. Further, it's just false to say that God is targeting maximum religious belief, because he could certainly have good reasons to withhold this for some people at certain times and places, and doesn't necessarily have an obligation to give every single person the maximum amount of revelation at every time and place. And if you want more details about this type of objection, and some other ones that are going to be popping up in this episode, I would suggest going back to the episode on divine hiddenness, where I can get much more in depth than what I'm doing here, because we're on to our next one. No, this one's my least favorite. I take it all back. Religion is just a crutch, a happy fiction to handle a hard life stemming from psychological factors like paternal projection. Why, you're just imagining some type of sky daddy. And you hear this type of trollish nonsense on the internet all the time. To which I might say, fine. In that case, atheism is a manifestation of pubescent hatreds of one's dad that immature and basement-dwelling internet trolls have not developed past, in part because of the brain-deadening effects of pizza rolls. Look, I can come up with unfounded and silly statements, too. In fact, it's kind of fun, so let me do it again. Atheism is just a crutch used by arrogant smooth brains to avoid having to admit that they can't track even simple theistic arguments presented by their intellectually superior theistic interlocutors. Oh, let's do one more. Atheism is a fantasy formed by people afraid of final judgment. Philosophically speaking, the effects of being potty trained too harshly can instill feelings of shame. The childhood wish to be able to successfully be alone in the bathroom is carried into adulthood, where the same shame trauma causes fantasies of ontological independence and the ability to be no longer under the view of an ultimate authority, like God, who represents the overly harsh parental caregiver during their toddling years. See, when I could absolutely come up with more, but you see how this kind of like pop psychology nonsense really isn't an argument, because I can make as many as I like of such statements. So just claiming it's a crutch, oh, it's a projection, no, it's just psychological factors, really? Prove it. Do it. Because I can make counterarguments all day long. And by the way, what makes this one particularly ridiculous, drives me absolutely yumpy, is that we hear objections like this surprisingly often, but we also hear in the very next breath how religion is somehow child abuse. For instance, Richard Dawkins has claimed that teaching kids about religion, particularly teaching them about hell, is worse than sexually abusing them. And I'm positive that Dawkins will be burning in hell for such statements. That is entirely insane. So which is it? Is religion a crutch? An idyllic projection of some type of magical world to deal with a tough life? Or is it so unidyllic, so horrible, and so scary that it's tantamount to child abuse? You need to pick a damn side, because this type of intellectual inconsistency is just embarrassing. It's evidence either of just a mind which can't recognize these two incredibly contradictory facts, or more likely, it's just evidence of sophistry and propaganda, not rationality and logic. You can't make both of these critiques. It's a crutch, an idyllic projection, and it's so unidyllic that it's child abuse. This is silly. But I'm not done ranting and raving. Apologists for atheism saying religion is a crutch is like an apologist for anorexia claiming that food is a crutch. What is that? You are so weak that you have to have food? Ooh, I'm hungry, poor me. I have to, or you have to, somehow run to your precious food like a crutch. Nah, you gotta be like me. Reject food, whistle up and die. Right? We understand that's clearly ridiculous if somebody was trying to push anorexia on us, which I don't think there's too many apologists for anorexia. But we wouldn't accept that as an argument. Why? Well, because if you're made for food, then you ought to eat it, and you will thrive if you do. Likewise, if you were made for religion, then you ought to be religious, and you will thrive if you do so. So this silly type of objection is just presuming atheism. It presumes that religion would make life easier also, which I think is quite the jump. I think the martyrs would have a word about that. Certainly Jesus would be giving you the side eye from the cross. Oh, what's this? Religion is a crutch? Religion somehow makes life easier? Jesus is really he would be scratching his head if his hands weren't nailed to a cross. So the idea that embracing cosmic levels of responsibility even for the good of one's enemies is somehow a crutch, and that dodging all moral responsibility and binding ethical mandates is somehow not a crutch, is a joke. If one of these is just an idyllic projection, it's the idea that you're never going to be called to account for anything you do. That seems like something that somebody would imagine up in order to try to live a better life. Not that you're incredibly morally bound to even love your enemies. That doesn't seem like some type of idyllic projection. That seems hard. That doesn't seem like a crutch. That seems like you're going to have to be doing an all-out sprint for holiness for the entirety of your life. So now, this is a silly objection. So do we have something better? Yeah, instead of this type of trollish nonsense, how about naturalism predicts what we observe, for instance, the many different types of religious phenomenon and the diversity thereof better than theism. One could analyze the various advantages long-term, evolutionarily, and find out that religiosity would arise. Therefore, given that evolutionary theory is native to the naturalistic paradigm, and it predicts religiosity in groups and various types thereof, we don't need God to explain this phenomenon, because we can explain it and we can do it with less things. It's a simpler theory. It explains everything. Bob's your uncle. That's better, right? I think that was much better. But I'll remind you, there are some theists who want to argue that religions would not arise naturally. But it is here. Ergo, this points to God. And that's an argument, but it's one that I don't really like. See the companion episode talking about things I like in theism and arguments I don't like for theism. This approach, I think, is wrong. Let me ask you, which of these two states of affair do you think point better to the existence of God? One, the very order of the universe itself is such that it will bring about religiously oriented rational beings. Does that point to God? Or B, the order of the universe is set up in such a way that it will not produce religious beings. But surprise, we have some. I think that option B is just kind of strange. It seems that if God existed in this reality, he seems to be acting against his own natural processes. Like, why would he create a universe that would not bring about rational and religious beings? Seems like he would, but now apparently he didn't, and then he does this special move afterwards. Further, I think the naturalist would say, well, look, I mean, clearly it's an atheistic universe, not targeting religion in any way, and hey, we're a fluke. Or, you know what, if it seems the universe wouldn't target religion, and yet we seem to have these things, maybe we're just a little confused, and we're actually in the option A universe, and we just don't understand nature very well. So of these two options, I think that option A is strongly predicted under theism. Thus, I fail to see how an atheist showing how religiosity would arise from evolution confirms atheism. I think if anything, it affirms theism. What in the naturalist paradigm base theory predicts the emergence of a universe that reliably arrives at a rational religious set of beings? I don't see anything in that type of theory, because they have a principle of indifference at the base of their theory, and we have a God at the base of ours. So one of those would predict an order of the universe that would bring about religious beings. One would not. So although at first blush, I think this stronger version of the argument, well, at least it's better than what we started with, when you look into it further, I think it actually tilts towards theism. The next one, you will hear people say, there is no evidence for God. What I hear when somebody says this is some version of, I am so close-minded and arrogant that I think my ignorance of arguments is evidence for their absence. Now, some people suggest in such a situation to ask nice questions like, well, what arguments have you heard? Or, well, what counts as evidence for you? And that can be a perfectly reasonable strategy. Sometimes it's quite an interesting strategy, because you'll hear some pretty absurd answers that would target, if they're targeting anything, a God that any thinking theist would simply call like an alien or an angel at best. But I think the best way to do this is to just throw people into the deep end of the pool immediately. You're claiming that there's no arguments, no evidence for God. Well, if someone doesn't believe in water, throw them in the pool. I would say something like, So that's interesting. You think that Aquinas' treatise in the De Ante et Insensia is not evidence for a being of pure esse existing? Where exactly in that argument do you think it fails? And then they'll have to admit that they've never read that. They don't know what it is, and they have no idea. They can't name a single premise. You go, wait a minute, I thought there was no evidence. You weren't aware of maybe the strongest argument that has ever been advanced? Oh, interesting. Or you can always steal a hilariously obtuse line from philosophy Barry Miller. You could say something like, what about the fact that no non-contradictory, non-elliptical construals of atomic sentences of the form A exist are possible? Is that not evidence? And if not, why not? Are you saying that we could have a non-elliptical construal of that sentence? And if so, what do you think makes ultimately determinate the meaning of that atomic sentence such that it's no longer elliptical or self-contradictory? And by the way, folks, that would be a great time to remind them that I wrote a 5-chapter children's book defending that thesis in rhyme. And if you would like that book, you can email me and I will send it to you. Also, I read it to you in a past episode from a while back called something like Thumper the Rabbit Defeats Atheism. So there's an entire rhyming children's book with a little bunny rabbit that explains that argument. I would invite you to check that out. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Like, if you didn't quite catch that one, there is a fictitious bunny and his imaginary friend who would love to explain it to you. And guys, I think ideally we ought to be able to explain things at any level, whether it's a really high academic level or a Thumper the Rabbit and his imaginary friend level. That's what I strive to do. Don't always do it, but I like to think I'm getting better. If someone asserts that there is no evidence for a God, your goal is not to stoop down to the thumper with rabbit level and explain things very simply. I think your number one goal, as mean as it sounds, is to reveal to them that they don't know what they're talking about, because their pride has stopped them at square one, and they can't go any further without first admitting their ignorance. Additionally, I would like to remind them that they are not only going against the consensus of theists, but also against many, if not most, professional atheist philosophers who would disagree that there are no arguments for God or there is no evidence for God. I mean, Graham Oppie, for instance, probably the greatest atheistic philosopher, candidly says that some theistic arguments are pretty good and that they do pose challenges and puzzles for atheism. He recently said exactly this in a recent episode on the Within Reason podcast with Alex O'Connor. So not only do they disagree with theists, they disagree with their own guys. Of course there's evidence towards it. You might not find it ultimately convincing. You might think that there could be reasons why it fails. You might say it's only like percentage chance this goes through, but to say that there's none is just strictly false, and you need to be shown that you don't know what you're talking about. Though another great way to respond is to simply ask them, list as many theistic arguments as you know, and try to lay one of them out. Because most of the time, when you get this type of objection, you will quickly find that they can't name many arguments, and if they can, they will terribly misrepresent it. And when they misrepresent the argument, don't offer to correct the argument. Just chuckle and say, nope, that's not how it goes. Also, listing a bunch of arguments is a great approach. Or asking them if they think that Plato and Aristotle believed in God can always be fun. That one stumps a lot of people, because Joe Atheist, who doesn't believe there's any evidence for God, probably hasn't read much Aristotle and Plato, because they're kind of displaying their ignorance here. So they might not know. And people don't want to be on the wrong side of Aristotle and Plato, because for most people, that just is a stand-in for really smart guys that I probably should agree with, at least. And I've had plenty of such conversations of this type and heard this objection many times, which is probably why I'm getting a wee bit salty in this episode. But the task here, again, is to show them that they know nothing. And if they're interested in learning, at that point, being like, oh, I don't know any of these, then kindly teach them. That's the point to jump in with the kindness. But if they want you to lay out an argument and you know they're just there to bash it, or to just fold their arms and say, no, I don't, that doesn't compel me, then don't tell them an argument. Just tell them that if you were actually open to learning about this, you're happy to do it. But if you're just standing there to try to swat down anything I'm about to say, then no, you're not interested in a dialogue. You're just interested in bashing my opinion. An analogy would be, it's like, hey, if I asked you about your mom and you knew that I was just going to respond by saying, fat old hog, then you wouldn't tell me about your mom. Likewise, you don't get to ask me about my religion just so that you can say, I think that's crap and it doesn't compel me. If you're actually interested, I'll lay out my case. If you're just here to be a jerk, then you can go on your way. And that sounds harsh, but let me tell you what happens next. The vast majority of people, when they're presented with, maybe I don't know, and then, no, I'm not going to tell you because I don't think you'll actually listen, they'll almost immediately try to prove you wrong and say, what do you mean? I'm very open-minded. I'll listen. And I've had belligerent drunk people do their best to pretend to be open-minded with that type of method. So in summary, if they don't believe in water, throw them in the deep end. Also, call their bluff and make them list arguments and lay them out. Next, explain that no one thinks that there is no evidence or no arguments for God, not even the smartest atheists. And the final method is just list a ton of arguments, because that's going to take them by surprise that you can name multiple ones. And finally, just refuse to lay out arguments if you think they're just there to bash, and tell them that they have no right to be taught your religion just so that they can throw rocks at it. All right, so what should you do instead if you are Bob the Atheist here? Instead of saying there is no evidence for God, which is a stupid claim, you should instead say, hey, I think that the argument from divine hiddenness is compelling. I would expect that more non-resistant non-believers would be finding God because, hey, they're not resisting the truth that God exists and God would want to make his existence known because it's how his creatures thrive. So I think that this is inconsistent with the claims about theism and our empirical evidence about how rational seekers end up not actually finding God in the real world. That's a better argument. I like that one. Divine hiddenness has some force. Do that one. And then after you do it, go to my episode on divine hiddenness. Because, well, that stuff's answered there. Number 4. This one gets my goat. I believe in science, not religion. Or we have other formulations which have become popular. Like, if all the science books were burned, they would eventually come back. But if all the religious texts were burned, they wouldn't come back, as if that's an argument. And as for this book thing, that argument's just assuming its conclusion. It assumes God doesn't exist, ergo, religion would not come back. And poof, God doesn't exist. I think you gotta think about these a little harder, guys. Quite obviously smuggling your conclusion into the first premise. And here's the thing. If God does exist, then why would he not reveal himself again? So, if God exists, then we would get religion back. If he doesn't, then we might not get religion back. Seems like the question is whether or not God exists. That's the fundamental thing at issue here. And if the objection is simply that we wouldn't get the same books, I mean, duh. It's not like Matthew would rise from the dead and rewrite his gospel. And nobody's saying that. Revelation of God was always and is always situated in a given time and place and people. I don't understand what that argument would be about. Nobody's claiming that, I don't know, the first century would happen again. And further, I was reliably informed that religion can be fully explained by the natural processes of evolution. There are people pushing this case. So in that case, apparently religion would come about again, and as a result of evolutionary selection. So at which case, apparently science comes back, and religion comes back. What about this whole I believe in science thing? Well, I find this one particularly funny because, one, it's not a retort, because there is no tension between science and, say, Catholicism. Like, none. Seriously, what is it? I'd love to hear it. I'll wait. Name a problem. There isn't one. Now, if you're, say, a young earth creationist, like Bible-thumping fundamentalist, well then, yeah, there's real tension between science and your faith. If you think the earth is 6,000 years old, yeah, that's a tension. A big one. And somebody's right and somebody's wrong. You're going to have to figure that one out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it. But for Catholicism, no, there's just no tension. It's just made up. It's not there. If you know of it, let me know, because I don't think it exists. Also, there's that nasty fact of all of these great scientists being heavily religious, like the guy who invented the Big Bang and the father of genetics. And you go down the list and you're going to find religious figure after religious figure also being an incredible scientist. And there's plenty that exist to this day. And finally, this line always seems to come from people who aren't scientists and wouldn't know an Erlenmeyer flask if it dropped on it on their toe. My wife is a scientist, and I have seen firsthand how the sausage gets made. And listen, science can be great and all that stuff, but yikes, the stuff behind the scenes would shake anybody's confidence. It takes a long time, it takes a lot of trial and error, and we can drift in wrong directions until the big-name scientists die, and then we can correct it. So, yeah, it's really something you hear from people who aren't scientists, and I think it's just completely a silly response. So what responses can we make here, in short? I would just say, no, there's no tension. If there is, why don't you name it? because it's probably going to be a misunderstanding. And also, I would point something else out that, hey, why do you like science? Well, it gives me real explanations. I agree, but let's take an example. Does biology give you explanations? Yeah. Well, what happens if we keep asking the why question to biology? Why do we have biological systems work the way they do? Chemistry? Well, yeah, that's right. It's chemistry. So what if we ask why questions about why chemistry works? And should we? Should we stop? Or should we just stop at chemistry? We don't need to know anything further? Well, no, we want to keep asking, right? And what's going to give us answers about why chemistry works? Well, physics, right? Okay, I agree. Well, should we stop there? Should we just like plow on our heels and say, that's it, we shouldn't ask any more questions, just kind of put down your head and walk in circles now? No, why don't we ask more questions? So if you like science because it answers questions, well, you should like, say, metaphysics because it answers questions even further. It actually brings us to a stop and ask questions about existence itself. Or at least you could ask epistemological questions like, how do we determine truth? You can ask all sorts of wonderful questions in philosophy, which are the questions you ask after you've asked physics. It goes beyond this and it hits the ultimate stop, questions about existence itself. So I think that the proper view is to be curious all the way to the end. That if you like science, you should eventually terminate in liking philosophy as well. And finding out what's actually grounding this whole shebang with regards to truth, existence, etc. So what's a better objection that you can make? I would say, instead, you should say that all observable facts can be explained with the natural sciences, and that God is an unnecessary complication to an otherwise perfectly satisfactory naturalistic hypothesis. Now, this is one, of course, Aquinas offers as an objection to belief in God, and is one that certainly continues. Now, do I think this one goes through? No. And to pump more people's work, good old Pefflin's new book tackles this one and the problem of evil a bunch, and he points out that naturalism does not explain everything in a satisfactory manner, and it's not simpler because it has to incredibly complicate its base theory in order to be able to be on explanatory par with the very simple theory, which is grounded in classical theism, a perfectly simple God. Number five. I don't know how this one gets passed off as an objection to theism, but you hear it all the time, and it's kind of been more popular lately, and that is, God told people to kill the Canaanites. Why Canaanites? Never has such an undeserving group got so much sympathy. I don't know, except for Hamas lately. Oh, the Canaanites. Will people please think of the Canaanites? From here, you can always check the Does God Command Genocide episode for details about how to answer these God told the people to slaughter the Canaanites, or, you know, people apparently forget about the Amalekites and the Jebusites and all the other guys. But Canaanites get all the press. God says, go slaughter these Canaanites. And if you want the details, go check out that episode. But here, I want to lay out a new theory, one that I've been doing a little bit of research on, and I ran by apparently everybody's favorite guest ever on the show, Dr. John Bergsma, and he liked it, and he encouraged me to continue looking into it, which I will at some point do. Reading from an email that I sent to him to kind of lay it out, here's what I say. The scriptural language that says to, quote, kill every man, woman, and child is a pronouncement that otherwise forbidden methods of combat that could endanger non-combatants are permissible. For instance, certain siege tactics or blind arrow volleys. God makes clear that the attacks of these people are a penalty for sin. As we all know, the penalties listed in the law are maximum penalties. Ergo, the penalty of women and children being killed is not a command, but an allowance for up to that much violence such that they too die. Scripture says to stone those who pick up sticks on the Sabbath. And obviously, don't stone the shivering grandma grabbing some firewood, but do stone the cult members gathering wood to burn children to Moloch in opposition of true Sabbath worship. So This does seem to be a maximum penalty, and that squares with the fact that their supposedly annihilated groups spring up a few chapters later. Why assume that the purpose of the pronouncement is to regulate what methods of warfare ought to be used? Well, other parts of the law do exactly this on an individual level. For instance, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, means that if you have not been attacked by having your eyes gouged or your face punched, then this method of combat is now off the table. Likewise, the law says if a robber breaks in at night, lethal or potentially lethal means of combat are permissible. Whereas, if it's daytime, these methods of combat are no longer permissible. And how do we surmise this? Well, it says that if one kills an intruder at night, they are not guilty of murder. Whereas if they kill one in the day, they are. So once again, we see how the maximum penalty in these individual cases regulate the method of combat that would be, therefore, permissible. So given that many of these passages stating that men, women, and children should be killed appear in the books of the law, or at minimum are explicitly stated to be cases of God's judgment, I think we ought to read them like we do every other law. Therefore, they are maximum possible punishments set in order to increase or decrease the options for permissible methods of combat. What I'm still looking into to support or disprove the thesis is whether or not the Israelites, without such a command, had a more restrained method of combat. It certainly seems like different cities are indeed treated differently, for instance, in Deuteronomy 20. My suspicion is that the language to, quote, slaughter everyone is a known phrase that implies elevated warfare in light of grave threats and against particularly evil groups. In a modern context, we are familiar with times where we must unlock otherwise impermissible tactics. For instance, in fighting the Nazis, few would oppose the strategy of bombing arms manufacturing facilities, which almost certainly have civilian women at work in them, and whose destruction could even cause collateral damage to nearby children. However, if the U.S. went to war with Iceland over a fishing dispute, it would be absolutely unthinkable to jump to such tactics of warfare. So we don't have a term for expressing the difference between these conflicts and the implied levels of violence that can be brought to bear. But I suspect that the Old Testament does, and we've been misreading it all along. That's my claim. I think that that phrase was a known idiom which unlocked certain methods of warfare. And indeed, we see, and my examples are arrow volleys and siege tactics, that the targeted groups were cities. In fact, some of them heavily defended or walled cities. So it's not meant to kill every woman and child. No, it's saying that it is permissible to do a tactic where it is foreseen that they could die. That's what's up with the Canaanites. And that's a principle we use today, right? I think it's entirely reasonable that if there's an enemy force powerful enough and evil enough that you can use types of warfare where collateral damage is not intended but foreseen, and that's what this meaning, what this meaning implies. We have support from other parts of the law. We have support from different areas of the text, which talk about different types of conquest. I think this is just flat out right. And it solves the problem. So there you go. So no bother with the Canaanites. Let's keep going. Religious people do terrible things. Well, look in the mirror. Atheist people do terrible things too. The Soviet Union comes to mind now, doesn't it? And also I'd add, where the heck are you getting your morality? The most reasonable of the atheistic moral systems, I think, is some form of emotivism, where you simply say that morality comes down to, say, yay, being nice to others, boo, murder. It's just an emotional expression of one's preference and nothing more. So I don't see how that's going to get you an absence of terrible things, just yays and boos. It's just going to get you, at best, a majority rule that oppresses the rest. Whereas in Christian morality, we actually care about people who are marginalized. Heck, we even care about our enemies. So, no, your system doesn't help people not do terrible things. It says there aren't terrible things, and everything is just an emotion that we have. I think this one's silly. Also, let's keep going. Albert Einstein was famously gullible. And if you don't know too many high-level physicists, I hear from those who I do know, it's actually a common fault, gullibility. So is there gullibility? Is a physicist's gullibility that they don't know physics? After all, gullible people can be easily fooled. Who's to say they're not fooled by another scientist, or fooled by data, or fooled by, I don't know, who knows what? Does their personal failing invalidate their whole field of study? Well, I don't think so. Not entirely. Could pose a problem, maybe. But if that doesn't invalidate physics, being gullible, then I don't see how being not able to uphold a high moral ideal somehow invalidates the thesis that God exists. That's entirely a non sequitur. Also, I seriously doubt that people would put their money where their mouth is. Let me just ask you, would you sooner put your wife or daughter or sister or mother in a room full of devoted Catholic daily mass goers who believe in all the tenets of the Christian faith, including care for women, children, love of enemies, do unto others as you would themselves? Would you sooner put them there, or a bunch of people who say, we're actually avowed atheists and we believe that there's no real moral claims on any of our behavior and that we are entirely indistinguishable from animals? Where would you actually put somebody you loved? Which room? Really? Of course people would trust the religious group more. So to say religious people do terrible things, ergo God exists, that's a total non sequitur. And then I don't think people would even act like this. Further, this makes the other absurd assumption that if God were real, then religious people would never do evil. And that, too, is a complete non sequitur. The idea if someone believes something, they would never act against their beliefs is entirely countered by the fact of human frailty. I mean, that's like saying that if people believe that kale is better for them than brownies, they would never eat brownies. They would only eat kale. Like, yeah, right, buddy. That's not how humans work. That's not how religious people work. So people fail. Even if they believe something, they can't always act in accord. That's a fact of human frailty, not a disproof of God. Of course. So here's a better argument. Things like sacraments are purported to reliably give grace to people, and grace makes them holy. Therefore, this is empirically verifiable. Yet people who receive such sacraments and ergo grace don't seem to be any more moral than people who do or do not. So these are not real, and at least this aspect of this religion seems to be false. And we could extend this to similar arguments about prayer. People who pray aren't any better, right? But we would expect they would be better. Here's my response. Please, please be my guest. Do the study. I dare you. Now, you can't be sloppy. You have to control for the fact that those who choose to be religious often do so because they recognize that they're in need of help. You have to control for economic status, zip code. You have to control for all the regular factors that would or would not influence the result. And once you do, I would put money on the fact that you will find an effect of prayer. You will find an effect of sacraments. I will put money on that. For sure. From a quick search, here's what I have found. As far as religious participation in life outcomes, a 2019 study published in the Journal of Religion and Health found that individuals who were baptized and actively participating in religious services tended to have better health and physical health, higher life satisfaction, lower rates of substance abuse compared to those who did not participate in religious activities. A 2018 study published in the Social Science Research Journal found that religious affiliation and baptism were associated with higher levels of income, education, and marital stability. A 2016 study published in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease found that individuals who were baptized and practiced their faith regularly had lower rates of depression, anxiety, compared to those who did not identify with a religious group. And in 2015, a study was published in the Journal of Religion and Health, finding that baptism and religious participation were associated with higher levels of forgiveness, life purpose, and overall well-being. A 2017 study published in the Journal of Community Psychology found that individuals who were baptized and participated in religious activities tended to have stronger social connections, even higher levels of civic engagement, and greater community involvement compared to those who did not participate in such religious activities. 2014 study published in the Social Science Quarterly found that religious affiliation and baptism were associated with higher levels of social trust, social capital, trust, and community adhesion. So those are the ones which I found. Just a few, and I'm sure there's more. So do it. Please do a rigorous study on the effects of the sacraments. And I'm sorry. I will put, hear ye. I will put a $1,000 bet on the fact that we will find a statistically significant result if you do a rigorous test on this. I think we should be open to such things. Number 7. But what caused God? First, I would ask, what do you mean by cause? Next, I would point out that there's three possible ways to answer this question. If we say, what caused God? We could say, well, there's no cause. And this is how we can examine anything. So we could say there's no cause. There's no brute fact. Or it was caused, but by something else. Or, well, it was caused, but by itself. These are the three things. So, for instance, if we say something is the way it is just for no reason, then it's a brute fact and is incredibly unintelligible, and I don't see how you could arrive at such a conclusion. Just life is entirely random and meaningless, and who knows what's going on. The next one is, well, it's through another, and the final one is, it's through itself. So one is throw up your hands and go, I don't know. Next one is through another, final one, through itself. So if we say, why is this pretzel salty? We could say, because of salt. Ergo, the pretzel is salty through another, through salt. If we say, why is salt salty? Well, it is salty through itself. So it contains within its nature the reason for its own saltiness. So what caused God to be? Well, it's either something that is through another or through itself. The claim about God is that it's actually the very stop of any chain, which is through another, and it arrives at something which isn't just a brute fact. That's actually the very opposite of what we're claiming. We're claiming that it's something which has its existence through its own nature. It is a being that exists because he is the I am. His essence is his existence. He's an entirely simple, self-existent being who has no parts, not even metaphysical parts. So he contains within its nature the reason for his own existence, not in an ad hoc way, not in a brute fact way, but as an appeal to what he is in his isness. No argument has any premise that says everything has to have a cause, as if it always has to reach outside of itself. Things must reach to their own natures. Otherwise, salt can't be salty, water can't be wet, one can't be unified, etc. So when we reach existence, we believe that existence can actually ground the reason for its own existence. So its essence is its existence, and this we call God. So no, the what caused God thing doesn't make any sense. What should you say instead? I don't know anything else. Maybe try to push the problem of evil. Maybe just try to defang the traditional arguments for God. Just don't use this one because it don't make sense. Number 8. This is a funny one. If you were born in another country, you'd be another religion. Okay, if I was born in another country, I might be Chinese. What's your point? Seriously, what's the point? The possession of other facts is more or less likely given place of birth. You're more likely to know calculus if you are born in Switzerland than if you were born amongst the glorious tribes of the Pygmies. Does that mean that math is relative? Does that mean that Pygmy math is somehow as good as the calculus that one would learn in like a Swiss high school? I don't think so. I have no idea what to say about this other than what are you even trying to say? God has no obligation to give everybody the exact same revelation at every time and place. Why would he? He has given us the appeal of conscience. He has given us a sense of the divine. He has given us the opportunity to have a natural type of religion. And inside of our Catholic faith, we believe he does extend enough grace that if we continually say yes to him, we get the type of union which leads to eternal life. So, what of it? All right, so here's a few things which I think are better to explore. I know I kind of named a few along the way, but if I was an atheist, here's what I would really pick on. This would probably be, well, there's the obvious, like the problems of evil and that naturalism is somehow simpler, that science can explain everything. You could do those. And I mean, some of those are all right. You know, there's questions to be answered. Go for them. Dig into those. But I really like the ones which say that the concept of God itself is self-contradictory. So ones like divine simplicity entails modal collapse, or that there's some type of impossibility of having existence without an essence which is separate from the existence, that we could just go against any type of realism. We could do some dodging moves. We could say that maybe pure actuality is somehow contradictory because any act entails some type of potentiality. We could say that necessity, like the necessity of God, entails a type of determinism that bleeds into the universe, making it determined, but it's not determined. Ergo, we don't have some type of necessary being which would determine such a cause. Some of those are better. I think they can be answered just fine. A lot of those are paper tigers, especially the modal collapse objections, I think, are just paper tigers. But if you have some which are vexing you, send them to me, and maybe we can do an episode for that, or toss them in the mailbag. I love those questions. I think this is something that should be pressed more by atheists, the idea that somehow God is self-contradictory. Some people do press that. And I think it's actually helpful for us because it can help us clarify what we do and don't mean by God. So these are wonderful conversations to have. We should have more of them. So if you're an atheist, don't do the dumb objections, which I was criticizing. Come at us with this, because this is good. I want to talk about this. I think that it's a better objection for you to launch, and it's a much better subject for us to talk about. Another one that I'll do a shout out to is, existential inertia. Now, this one doesn't actually target all the types of arguments for God, but it does target some. Now, what I don't like about this is I don't like the temporal framing of the argument. The idea that there's like a time one and a time two and things exist from time one to time two. I think that the way that I look at time that I've kind of explained in some other places, I believe that time is derivative of act and potency. So I think that as soon as you start talking about time as if things can persist with some type of existential inertia through time, I think you're just begging the question and we're back to act and potency. So one of those actualities is the actuality of existence, which I think grounds the possibility of the present moment. And then there's actuality and potentiality, which causes different categories of change. So I think that if you take like a view of time that I take, and apparently we learned recently, Avicenna takes, then I don't think you can even launch this objection because you're fundamentally misunderstanding time. Ergo, yeah, your whole temporal framing of the question is undercut. So that's what I have to say about that. Further, there's some people who treat it. I know a lot of these people say, no, we're not treating it like a property, but I mean, let's just break it out. Let's say you are saying it's a property. So it's kind of like color or weight. There's a thing and then it has this property, in this case of existence. Then in that case, there has to be a thing which grounds this property. So that's kind of a chicken or the egg problem, isn't it? That you have to have a thing to ground a property, but the existence is the property that's needed in order to then ground any property. So I don't think you can say that it's something which is added to that type of thing. It doesn't make sense. It's just a contradiction. You need the thing to ground the thing, but you need the grounding to ground the thing to ground the thing. So chicken or the egg problem. I don't think that's a valid way to envision reality. So if, however, it's not a property, but it just is the ground for a property, then that's fine. But I fail to see how that would make it no longer a cause, need a cause for its persistence. Why? Well, because either it has its existence through itself or through another. And if it's through itself, because of itself, then it could not pass out of existence because it has it through its own nature. And it couldn't come into existence because its nature simply, apparently, is the possession of existence. But things do come into existence and go out of existence. Thus, they don't have existence as proper to their nature, but they have it through something else, which is fine. Thus, they are caused to exist by something outside of themselves. And if we find something that exists through its own nature and cannot fail to exist or come into existence at any point because it just has necessity through its own nature, then that type of necessary existence is none other than, well, the God of classical theism, which we apparently have just arrived at. Further, if we look at the conditions for a thing to exist, we do have a sustaining cause. Its parts. So if there's a dog, it's caused to exist because his parts exist. And we could add that he also seems to have an organizing principle such that these parts exist in the arrangement which is recognizable as a dog. So if this sequence of dependence continues infinitely, then it can't actually explain the top-level thing under consideration. Instead, it has to terminate in a being that is completely simple, one without parts, one that grounds all reality in one simple act of existence, and that, too, we call God. Joe Schmid, at the Majesty of Reason, has a book and a gigantic article on this type of objection. And I think it's, I covered it pretty briefly with some pretty broad strokes here, but you can look at some of Ed Fazer's responses. I think he has some on his Blogspot, and that's a fun type of discussion. Existential inertia, well, I think it can be diffused in a variety of ways. I've kind of sketched out a few, and there's different formulations of this objection, so I may not have hit exactly what people may have had in mind, but in short, this is a good discussion. It would, if we could solve this and figure this out and get clarity on this, then I think we could all agree we would understand a new thing about reality. Do things need a continuing cause for their existence? Or once they get existence, can they keep on chugging? That's an interesting question. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about that instead of religious people mean sometimes. Hashtag Canaanites. That's not profitable, but this is. Let's talk about this stuff. In short, I think we all should be using the best arguments. We should all try to be consistent in our thinking. We saw a bunch of times where the atheistic objections, let's hope they're not being held by the same person because they're just contradictory. We should all try to be consistent to seek the truth. I think there's a variety of theistic arguments that either make theism highly probable or just outright demonstrated as fact. In the atheistic arguments, the good ones anyway, I think are pretty few and far between and have some pretty solid answers. I'm sure I could have named some other atheistic arguments, but I'd say they probably, what I would have named would have fallen into the category of critiques of theistic arguments. For instance, you often hear, well, infinite regresses are possible, or, you know, you're trying to divide regresses into two categories, one which is essentially ordered and then accidentally ordered, but there is none. It's just all accidentally ordered. Or you hear people who, with a straight face, try to defend a type of circular causation, occasionally importing different views of time, which I think are entirely ridiculous and actually disproved by science, because we do have entropy as a way of seeing which way the era of time works. So in circular causation, we're apparently flowing back against entropy, which is nonsense. And by the way, I think that can be reduced to act and potency, because potency has a variety of different ways that it could take, and then actuality determines it to one or another. So we actually have a kind of mapping onto what we see with the whole entropy arrow of time stuff. But in anyways, that's a digression. And those critiques of arguments, while maybe we can do an episode at some point of the best critiques of theistic arguments, they are not arguments positively asserting atheism. There are a few. We kind of talked about a couple. We've covered the problem of evil, especially me and Pat Flynn's episodes have covered those. His book is a wonderful place to to check out. So his The Best Argument for God's the name of it. I am linking what John DeRosa wrote about dealing with a bunch of atheist slogans. The list is probably pretty similar to what I laid out here. That's a wonderful place to look. If there's any questions, objections, mailbag questions, which you would like to send to the podcast, please do that. Email me at thegordianknot101@gmail.com. I'll throw that in the show notes as well. I love when you guys reach out. Do me a favor if you can. Hit the buttons to rate and review the podcast. And that helps more people find it. And also, you can help more people find it by simply sharing it if you find it helpful. If you didn't, then never speak of it again. But if you do find these episodes helpful, I hope you share it with a friend. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the next episode.